You are listening to the Fresh Take Network.
What it is, what it do, welcome to Fresh Take, the Adam. William Arbuthnot and the talented, sexy, dangerous, the Devonier. It's Devin Seal.
Faster and cleaner, chef.
Yeah, we got to talk about that. We got the Acolyte. We got the boys. And most impressive today, we are live on a lot of platforms. We are live on X. We are live on YouTube. We are live on Instagram for your viewing pleasure.
Not Truth Social.
Definitely not that. Well, feel free to all those that are going to tune into us to, you know, leave comments as we go on and talk about everything in the world of pop culture. Dev, where do you want to start?
I just watched The Boys this morning. I think that'll be a relatively quick conversation, so.
Yeah, tell me what you thought about the episode.
I think I've said this before, and I'll say it again. I was telling you off air as well. I feel like the show is leaning in towards gross out, juvenile, and gore humor. And it's becoming a crutch. I don't think that these kind of things... are really enhancing the storyline. I think they're there to make people kind of laugh. But then again, my sense of humor is not Deadpool, which I think leans more into Deadpool or that type of humor, frat boy stuff, than some of the cerebral stuff that I like from other shows.
Right.
You know, we've had two episodes since, do we talk about last week's? I don't think so. So we had two episodes, right?
Yeah, we had two episodes.
Last week was like the killer farm. And I appreciate it from a creative standpoint. But after like 20 minutes, I just got, you know, kind of tired. And I wasn't grossed out. I didn't think anything was like too vulgar or too... And I'm sure you'll touch on this in other shows. Like the CGI was fine and whatever. But there's just so many people exploding, and yeah. I'm not really sure how that makes me feel anymore when we're supposed to push forward this clash of superhero deities versus the regular Joes.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you in some points, like as far as the boys go, I am a little bit sick of the over gratuity of violence and of sexual nature. At some point, you do got to tell a story. And that has been few and far between.
Well, it's like they're like, we get it that Ashley took a shit in Homelander's toilet. Like, we've brought that joke up like three or four times now. We get that she's like a dominatrix type personality. And it just seems like every single like weird side character that we meet that the boys are supposed to get information from has some sort of dirty, dark secret that or addiction or mental personality disorder or mental illness that the boys take advantage of, which is fine. Yeah. And it's fine the first few times, and it's fine to push buttons, and it's fine to know people's trigger points. But it's almost to the point that every time someone is introduced, they're just really messed up. And we talked a lot about this with Frenchie's character arc. I mean, we haven't seen him this episode because now he's in prison for some reason or another.
He turned himself in.
Yeah, I know he turned himself in. But I mean, I appreciate the emotions that he's going through. But that's a different point altogether. Almost every single hero that we see has some kind of problem, an actual real problem. And I'm kind of wondering if that is a deliberate choice by the authors or showrunner Or is this just that we're relying on these lack of character developments to push the story forward? Because basically what happens every episode is Butcher or whoever finds some random character that we're never going to see again, gives them a bunch of drugs, or tells them that they're going to leak their weird sexual fetish and that they have to do what they want. And then they go, okay. And then they tell them the little bit of information that they do know, and then, you know, rinse and repeat. And they die, or Homelander finds them and kills them, and there we go. So,
yeah.
You know what? Like, what are we, like, what are we doing? I know what the end goal is, obviously. I mean, stated every time Butcher opens his mouth. Good call on Jeffrey Dean Morgan's character, by the way.
It seemed pretty obvious.
Yeah, you know what? I missed it the first episode or two. I think they did a really good job of framing it. Like, they don't have anyone in the background. They don't have, like, you know, there's always the two of them together in, like, some isolated area, like the break room or a picnic bench or whatever, which was, you know, nice little trick. And then the last two or three episodes, it becomes way more apparent. Because you're right. Like, he never actually directly talks to anybody. He's just always pushing.
No. And I mean, I think you kind of got apparent in this episode at times. Like, okay. Like, it took me about two minutes or so to click in. I'm like, yeah. And I mean, and you kind of saw the turn coming to that he was going to talk to his wife, right? That the figment of Jeffrey Dean Morgan was going to talk to his wife at some point. And then it was going to click for Butcher. Like, as they kind of had the three of them gathered together, like, okay, this is what's going to happen here.
Do you like the idea of him, like, talking out loud to nobody, or would you rather it be in his mind that he's imagining it?
I mean, I'm good either way. I would have appreciated more if, you know, Newman's lover, boyfriend, husband, whatever he is, if he would have been more like, who are you talking to?
Sure. I mean, at that point, he's probably so terrified. He's probably so terrified that he's just not going to say anything, considering that guy, like, so how did he, like, did he amputate his leg? Did he chop his leg off with a karate chop? Did he use laser vision?
I'm sure he probably got a hacksaw or something like that.
Yeah, like, how do you sit still for that? Like,
I mean, also too, I mean, remember too, he has, like, this substance in his brain that killed Ezekiel. So
yep.
Obviously that was probably the way he did it. I guess, remember, we're dealing with superheroes here with extraordinary powers, and whatever the Jeffrey Dean Morgan side is, like, his venom,
sure,
kind of alter ego now, that was probably the one that unfortunately took that guy's leg.
So I guess my question is, okay, so those are two examples of him using his powers. Let's say that him chopping the leg off is using powers, or Jeffrey Dean Morgan, or whatever. They definitely insinuate with the Ezekiel stuff that he was not in control of it and it just happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then he loses control again just to chop this guy's leg off to do exactly as much damage as he wanted to and not just turn him into red mush. So there is control or there isn't control. I'm not really sure what this alter ego or Jeffrey Dean Morgan's character or even just Butcher in general brings to the table if we're getting all these different examples of this violence. So he ends up kidnapping, I think his name's Saeed.
Yeah, I believe
Salim, so. Salim, Saeed, something like that. In order to throw people off the trail, he cuts off his leg to then force him to do what he wants to make the super virus. Like, that's pretty calculated. Versus Ezekiel, did Ezekiel need to just explode into red jelly? Because he didn't
Blacked out, Butcher, right? I mean,
yeah, Butcher didn't remember that.
In the bunny, there was some kind of, like, again, venom-like substance, which is obviously in him. So whatever it is, that's why I'm kind of like, he kind of has a symbiote, more or less.
Yes. But then that symbiote, like, furthered his plan deliberately with the baby daddy.
Yeah.
And I know they haven't given us really any answers. They're giving us a lot of clues, especially with the thing, like, going through around his brain, and of course, in the rabbit, are definitely the same thing. You're right. I think it's probably like a symbiote, but does it have its own personality?
Seems like it.
I mean, who's to say? We don't know yet, right? So, or is it just
it seems like it, you know, it feeds off the brain. And sure. So it obviously feeds off, you know, the light, let's just say, with what his wife is. And then it feeds off the dark, which is the Jeffrey Dean Morgan character, which I'm not sure what the relation there is. I think that they fought together or something, because he said, you left me for dead a while ago, and you know that. So I'm not sure.
That might exactly. be. Well, they definitely worked some kind of black ops job together. Mm-hmm. And it was probably the closest thing that he had to a friend going through that dark time. I think the symbiote feeding off of emotions is a bit poetic for this show. It seems like they don't really believe in like the power of love, you know, kind of like Marvel does or other kind of like cartoons or anime. Mm-hmm. You know, this symbiote worm thing might just literally live off of brain tissue or blood, or like that seems more realistic in the Boys universe than feeding off of the memories of his dead wife. So then it leads you to believe, if that thing exists and it's not actually a tumor, it's actually a living being of sorts. Maybe the tumor is alive and it's like a separate, you know, whatever. Theoretically, you'd be able to extract that.
Yeah.
So, and that's kind of where I'm leaning towards this thing. Like, I like the idea of things of change in shows, right? And the Boys is not popular just because of Carl Urban. So if Butcher really were to die, the show would move on and it would be different, but that's okay. But I'm really getting the sense of feeling that they want to keep 5 or 6 actors alive literally as long as possible. And so, you know, I'm not going to dismiss the idea that there's going to be some kind of magic extraction technique, or maybe Homelander literally lasers Butcher in the head and just zaps that thing out of it and he's totally okay. I have no idea, but I really do feel like something's going to come around and then save Butcher. And
we do know the next season's the last season.
Okay. Yeah. And I've said this since like the very first season. Like I've been watching the show to keep up with it. It's a bit of a water cooler show. Mm-hmm. It definitely fits within our demographic. It definitely is taking shots at all the Marvel stuff and the DC stuff. And I think that the premise is really great. But the same thing with the Acolyte is that we've kind of lost sight of the intent of the property. The intent of the property is to show not superheroes having orgies and doing giant cocaine binges and shooting webs out of their ass because they're high.
It's not.
No, it's the idea of like them being a superior being going to their heads and then deciding that they can run things better than humans can. Which, I mean, every time Homelander's on screen, most of the time Homelander's on screen, it's really captivating because he's using his tools to elevate his standing. I mean, he could, in reality, like, he could just zap anybody who stands in front of him. He could shoot down jets and tanks in the army. But then what would happen? Like, so what he's trying to do is he's trying to rule, or he's trying to gain power through persuasion or fear or both, probably, so that people give him the keys to the kingdom willingly. And I like seeing that. Yeah. I like seeing that meeting. I liked seeing the idea of like corporations kind of running America and they're so rich and powerful, because then all he has to do is CEO of this corporation and install a new one. And he suddenly starts to own that company like he has with Vought now.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Some of the other stuff, like, you know, the firecracker stuff, kind of lame. The black noir stuff, kind of lame, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's just where I said
black noir stuff was funny. I did like the Animal Farm side of things. Like, that was kind of what the unique theme of the Boys is, of like, oh, it's a killer sheep. Like, you kind of the idea that this bull is going to attack you and then it gets mauled by some killer sheep was pretty hilarious. But I do find kind of like I'm finding with a few of these shows, which is why I did like The Acolyte this week, where I found this with The Bear as well so far, as it's kind of in a lull of just kind of repeating the same things. Now, The Bear I have different issues with, but this is just kind of like at a lull, kind of just I'm kind of at you. It's the idea of the high level of violence and sexual nature to get your attention instead of high level storytelling. Whereas they had the stuff with Kimiko at the end, and I'm like, that's something I'm interested in. I am interested in the story of Kimiko and finding family and her being mute and trying to literally find her voice, not just as a human, but what it is to be human.
Yeah, I'm interested in the character relationships. I'm interested in their interweavings, you know, Firecracker and Starlight, or Homelander and Starlight. Like I like building on those things because you never know who's going to use who for what end. Then what happens is you then, like, you're right about the storytelling part where they have this hour-long episode that really could have been 42 minutes. If you would have cut out like all the sex dungeon stuff, because guess what? Like, I don't care about Tech Knight. I never have. I probably never will. Like, you could have had Huey go down into the basement and then there'd be some kind of table with straps on it. And he goes, oh crap. And they cut away from it. And then it leads you to your imagination of what they're going to do to him, whether it be sexual or surgical or violent or whatever. And instead, we have to watch, you know, the Ashley actor masturbate and then rub herself on Huey's face. Like,
I didn't need that repeated, but okay.
Well, I'm just trying to be mature about it. Like, when I'd way rather have Homeland, I'd really way rather hear Homelander talk to these CEOs and senators and hear the things that they want from him to get support. And like, we know he's not the sharpest tool in the shed. He doesn't want to be judged. He doesn't want to be put down or anything. So he surrounded himself with someone like, you know, like Sister Sage, which is a great move. And even someone like Newman, like, I think it's a little trite to just have her turn sides so damn easily, but like, you know, or I'd love an indication of her, you know, playing both sides, of her being like, how can I destroy Homelander but still become the president? But it just seems like she's just has gone like full heel turn now, to use a wrestling phrase.
I think she's out for her own survival, right? She's kind of at that point where she's just going to do whatever she can to take the presidency, right? And she knows aligning herself with Homelander and these billionaires is the case for her to get to where she ultimately wants to be. We don't know if, you know, if she is part of this idea with the internment camps and everything like that.
Right.
For sure. I mean, Huey even said, like, do you think Vicky knows? So we don't know if Newman is as far as knowing that, where, you know, obviously Sage and Homelander have that idea and that's part of their grand plan. But we don't know if Newman has that idea, or, you know, even if she's like, oh, I just had a guy mansplain abortions to me, like, I'm sick being here. Right. So she obviously has a different level of political ideology than what Homelander has, but she saw an opportunity where these are going to be people, as Sage told her, that are going to be someone that can help and boost you to the presidency. So she saw an opportunity to take that and she ran with it.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And this is where I think we run into the conflicting ideas of like, okay, so what I'm saying, what you're kind of saying, is that we want to see more of Newman do these backroom deals, or what she's thinking or what she's planning.
I want story.
Exactly.
Story on TV right now is House of the Dragon. And it's not even close right now of the current shows that are airing right now.
Okay.
And it's because story. There is a story. The three shows that we were pumped about during this June and now into July, between Acolyte, Bear, and The Boys, are all lacking story, of a consistent flow of story. And for all their different reasons, they get caught up in different tropes. Whereas I do find... Story? What is?
You think The Boys, or it's not The Boys, The Bear?
Yes. We'll get to it.
Hard disagree, but I'm interested to hear what you have to say. So I don't have much to say about else about the boys. I'm just getting tired of, okay, here's a 15-minute scene of penises and blood and exploding, when I'd rather just see talking and dialogue.
I would agree.
With the occasional lasering, the occasional powers, not every friggin' power every time for everything.
Yeah. Let us move to the Acolyte.
Okay, you were higher on this episode.
I just like this episode because I think Kumir is a really good character, and it shows a different way to seduce someone to the Force. Literally seducing on one side, but not the way that Palpatine we've seen be like the main seducer of the dark side, right? At least in animation, video games, all that, it's been Palpatine, it's been Vader. This was a different tactician, and Kylo, I guess, to a degree as well. This was a different way of seducing someone to the dark side, and a very more calming effect, not so sinister, where you see his reasons for the dark side and being a dark side user, you can kind of be like, huh, I kind of understand why he would believe that. Because the way that he talks about it, and he's calm about it, and he's very reasonable in some ways about his position of being a Sith. He's very, very good at that, of seducing. He's very calm in the way that he seduces compared to, obviously Palpatine, when he's, first lured Anakin in, was also to a degree like that. But I found his approach quite interesting.
That's a really unique perspective. You're probably not the only person to feel that way.
The stuff in the spaceship was stupid. That was stupid. Sure.
Yeah.
The stuff with May was stupid. This
and
stuff
and...
with Kumir and with Osha, that stuff I liked. The stuff on the ship was dumb.
Oh yeah, that's fine. I definitely agree with you there.
It felt like a Benny Hill episode.
A little bit. They were kind of running through different doors and like running
when
into each
like,
other.
When she's like grabbed her leg and like stepped on her foot. I'm like, what am I watching?
And then it's funny how Saul used the stun gun.
I'm so sick of this guy. I have to tell you a secret. No.
That's a really good point. We'll just skip over that stuff because I think we both dislike it for
dude. When I'm like, when he's like, I will finally tell you the great secret, and then I was like, they're gonna fucking roll the credits, aren't they? And it's like, I'm like, oh my god.
And then they used the classic outro as if it just accomplished some major victory in Star Wars fandom. When I was like, I actually felt more mad when they had like the starry
everyone
background.
Did. The people that really liked the last episode of it were like, okay, like, where are we going? And it was like, generally listening to reviews, a lot more people are where I am, where the stuff in the ship was dumb. Not a fan of. I did like the stuff with one of the head Jedi and her Padawan going there, and you see an actual Jedi is like dead.
Right. Yeah.
Like just dead. Like that was new. Like we hadn't seen really that, like this, like the dead corpses there. That was wild. Like especially
minus
for Disney too.
Minus the 10 times we've seen Order 66, but I hear your point for sure.
Yeah. So I didn't expect that. And I mean, it's obvious that she betrayed Kumir and used her lightsaber whip on him, and that made him turn. Now, for what the reason was, we don't know. I mean, we know some of these masters, it doesn't take a lot, just talk to Luke with his nephew. I had a bad dream.
Don't get me started on sequel era stuff. This episode in particular was shot very, very similarly to how Force Awakens and Last Jedi were shot, it seemed like. Using the little animals in the foreground and people kind of walking in the background. It felt like they did their very best to kind of emulate a movie feel more so than any other. Like the last couple episodes, especially in the forest, you could tell was like the Mandalorian green screen in the background kind of thing, and the trees in the foreground. this episode in particular is very much like shot on location, and it gave such an interesting feel, because for a second, like when Kimir and Osha kind of are in his lair, like you almost feel like, is he on act two? Like, are we gonna see some porgs like flying around here? And of course they're on some nameless planet we've never heard of.
Our version of porgs.
Yeah, and but you know what? I felt way more invested. Like I felt way more sucked into their conversation, knowing that they weren't just standing in front of a green screen. I didn't tell myself that, but my brain felt that way.
They were like little like elephant seahorses.
Yeah, sure, but they were cute. I mean, it's funny. Like if Disney made a little plush of that more so than any other thing, they'd probably sell more of those just by accident, just because they're cute, rather than like trying to force feed us some stuff. But even him just swimming in the bay with the rock formations and the water and the crashing waves and the relentless pounding of water, like that was just a nice little change up to these sterile environments where everything is CG. Yeah. So I'll give the episode credit for that. The whole idea of like of Saul like knowing this terrible secret, or he's complicit in some kind of crime, I think is also kind of, or even like this, what's the master's name of the green lady? I don't know.
Rao. Ventress Rao. Or Ro. It's R-W-O-H.
So I need to figure out, right, or they sure need to start explaining if this big transgression that happened was something that the Jedi did that was morally wrong, that we all agree is a bad thing to do in any society, and at which case I have really strong questions about the Jedi, about Disney's interpretation of the Jedi Order in this era, where we have like people who are like blatant criminals running around doing like with the power getting to their head, who were not addressed by the Order or Yoda or anybody else being like, what you're doing is wrong. Because if you remember distinctly, Count Dooku's one of the Fallen 20.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, reason to believe there are only 20 Jedi who've ever left the Order. So Osha and Kimir and like, so what's going on here? If we're to believe, or we're led to believe through the Republic era and Clone Wars, that the Jedi were a force of good, although they were disillusioned, although they were losing their power, their grip on the Force. Other than Barriss Offee, like, they didn't quite necessarily, like, they weren't criminals. And so what we're going to hear is, like, this high-ranking green-skinned Jedi assaults her Padawan for whatever reason it is, and blatantly just attacks him. Rather than using any kind of resources that the Jedi have in the High Republic era.
Is she his master?
I mean, that could be it too.
It's the power of two there, and he now wants his own pupil. That's why he wants an acolyte.
So you think she's dark side this whole time, hey?
I think so. I'm starting to think so.
If that were to be the case, I'm not going to admit that I would be totally against it. I'd be rather interested. But what I was kind of telling you via text message, and this is a little bit having to do with the boys, the people who wrote this show have lost track of the driving force of this show. And I don't mind having these like fish out of water with the twins being the people that the audience relates to. But now that Kimir actually has a lot of bit of depth to him, whether I agree with that or not, which I, you know, we'll talk about that in a minute or so, I'd way rather hear his perspective through five episodes and him talking to a shadowy figure, giving him orders, or him talking about getting revenge on his master, or rather than pushing us, like we got pushed down this friggin' CSI Jedi version for like four episodes.
Yeah, the show went the wrong direction.
Yes, 100%.
I think we can all agree we all like Manny in this. I think that's the one for everyone that's like, this is a very split show and what you think about it. There's some people that absolutely love it. There's some people that absolutely hate it. And then there's some people that are in the middle. It's one of those few shows that has all three directions. I think the one thing everyone can agree on is that Manny is the best part of the show. And we like his character.
I like how he acts. I like the way he looks. The helmet's really growing on me. The lightsaber's really growing on me. I'm a little flustered with another Sith Lord who's like, the Jedi had failed me. And because I feel let down, I need to exact revenge on people to show, to teach them a lesson. That's getting boring. Every single dark side user is always like, just basically the only person who like doesn't feel that way is Palpatine. And he's just like such a comically evil bad guy at this point that he doesn't really have any nuance. So I'd really like to see a Sith user who taps into aggression and fear and whatever, not for revenge, not to try to overthrow and destroy the Jedi. Because if you know those, like, you know those poems you've seen on like displates and stuff, and like, you know, hope leads to whatever and passion leads to whatever, like, and you get the good guy and the bad guy one. Like, I'd like to kind of explore that poem a little bit more through someone else's perspective. And I think Manny could have been that person. You know, maybe he would have been, I would have liked to see him, like, he was identified as being a Force user. Maybe he was like, maybe the Jedi thought that he didn't have enough Force potential, and someone rescued him and then taught him to, you know, tap into it, rather than him just be like, oh, like, my master didn't like what I said and she slashed me with a lightsaber. And it's like, what the fuck's going on here?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would say the show is out of like the red for me. Like, we're in a nice little like yellow right now.
Okay.
It is at least at a point where I am interested to watch the show next week, where, as I told you beforehand with it, it was just like, all right, here we go. I am now like interested and built up towards ideas, but this is the problem that we have with a lot of the Disney shows in the past of like, we have two episodes left and they have all this shit to get to. How are they going to get to it?
Well, then it's, you just know that they're going to answer, like, so let's say we have three questions going in. They're going to answer two of them and leave the big one, like, you know, who's his master for season two. I just pulled this up really quickly. Here's the Sith code. Peace is a lie. There's only passion. Through passion, I gain strength. Through strength, I gain power. Through power, I gain victory. Through my victory, my chains are broken. The Force shall free me. That sounds way more intriguing than be like, wham, my babysitter like forgot about me.
Yeah.
So that's what I, the only problem I have with Manny's character is I think he's a little one-dimensional. He's a little too hell-bent on revenge of the Jedi doing bad things to him.
When sounds like another character that we've just a few years ago. People on Reddit and whatnot have been calling him Smilo Ren.
Yes, Smilo Ren, absolutely. Well, that's the same. I mean, we could talk about
Kylo Ren. He has a lot of similarities to Kylo, like a lot of similarities to Kylo and Ben Solo.
And that's that goes to my point of like just being people who are like, oh, you let me down. Like, I need to teach you a lesson. Like, can we just move on? Like, can we do something else with our lives?
Two episodes of that left. The bear. Where are you on the bear?
Pretty high.
What's high? No, like what episode?
Oh, okay. I have finished episode 9, but we're going to talk about the first couple, right? Or we're going to talk about as a whole?
I've seen up to 6.
Okay.
I don't have a lot to say, so you can kind of go into it. I just think that this show is kind of came off very pretentious to me this season around. The one review I've heard a lot of it likes the smell of its own farts, which I think is a bit strong, but there's just a lot of stylistic choices that it's going to make, and it may be too artsy for me. I don't know, but I just find this show in such a lack of direction. I watched by far the episode that AO did, Napkins, is a masterpiece, and Barenthal is awesome. Yeah. The actress that plays Tina, Lizza, Colin, Zayas, she's awesome. She's fantastic. But I, you know, the first episode, still is stylistically great, but I just kind of wanted to get into the restaurant. There's just all these different flashbacks and different stylistic choices, and holy shit, do they like to put the camera right on the actors' faces so much. It drives me crazy, the camera choices that have been in this season. And then you have John Cena for like no reason, really, like just the random cameos that you have in it. And the whole storyline more or less is, oh, we changed the menu and then we have a review coming in. And how's that review going to be? And it just kind of seems like some of the same beats that we're dealing with, that we dealt with from prior seasons, just kind of reimagined to a different degree. That's just my provocative. I understand there's people that still like it, but there is more people that are mixed on this season at best. I'm not going to take it as a whole review until I finish it off entirely. It's still a really well done show. I just find that this season has a very lack of direction compared to the prior seasons, where I don't like, there is storyline beats there, but they are so interconnected and so it's sparse to take other stylistic choices that I think it deviates from the overall show.
I think that's fair. And as we just kind of talked about the Jedi code versus the Sith code, it's kind of like two sides to a coin, right? Do you like the stylistic choices that they're making or do you not? It seems so. You're right about it being like self-indulgent, and it definitely has what I also read about in a couple of reviews was that to flip the term self-indulgent to being confident, really, really confident. This show has no problem sticking to one idea and just pushing it on you because,
sure.
And it's up to you whether to accept that or not. And then it's up to you again later to accept, you know, to think if you like it or not. And those don't have to be the same thing. We can accept it and choose not to like it. We don't have to accept it, choose not to like it, whatever. The show has, I would say that the tropes of the show of season 3 are not the same as they were in seasons 1 and 2. Because the idea has come forward, the change has happened, and season 3 is definitively dealing with them now being in a routine. The restaurant's been redone. And what happens is now, just like when you and I have routine, or we kind of get in the humdrums of work or whatever, and everything's kind of taken care of, those little things that you didn't notice when the big changes were happening suddenly become big deals. And the show, especially, we saw it a little bit in season 2, where the show has no problem breaking away from the action to give you a story point that could have worked elsewhere in the show, but because you're so invested, it's kind of like a palate cleanser. Napkins is a phenomenal episode. There's literally I have no negative notes towards that. You're right. The actor who plays Tina is like such a powerhouse and played off of Barenthal so well. And Ayo Adebiri did a commendable job in her first directing debut. Could we have seen that earlier? Could we have seen that later? I don't really know. I'm actually kind of interested in the idea of, we spent so much time in the first season getting to know these characters that now what's happening is they're giving us little slices of their life. And then like just that make you re-examine why someone like Tina has stayed. How did they get there? Right. Well, why has Tina stayed so long? Why does Tina believe in Carmi? Because quite frankly, her brother gave her a chance when no one else would. She feels a sense of loyalty, not to Carmi, but it's to Michael. And because for a 10-minute stretch, they got each other. They understand each other. They're kind of the same person. They think the same way. And then it goes on to a later episode. It references that in just a really quick blink and you miss it nod. So this show is going to be the ultimate, especially seasons 2 and 3, because they filmed them together. This is going to be the ultimate film nerd kind of thing, where people are going to stitch a single scene in episode 4 of season 2, and then the same thing from a different perspective happened in a flashback in season 3, for example, right? And so what's happening is in seasons 2 and 3, they're building all this world, but from multiple viewpoints. No longer are we like, the show isn't even that focused on Carmi and Carmi that much anymore, to an extent, but this wouldn't have been able to happen unless we gave him a lot of room to operate in season 1. And now we're starting to flesh out, you know, Ayo Adebiri's character, or sorry, Debri's character is getting like, you know, shine consistently through the episodes, but then like Marcus gets an episode, Tina gets an episode, Richie gets an episode. And now when we do see Carmi, we're focusing on how they're interacting with him, and very little of it has to do with their personal relationship. It has to do with what we've realized years ago, or with their brother, or with their mom, or with the uncle, why they believe in him. So I think that's kind of the feelings from the show. The theme is that Carmi's pursuit of perfection, he doesn't love it. He's not in love with he's so focused on the end goal that he's lost sight of the enjoyment of all the steps to get there, which is why he's like melting down. It's why he's melted down for like the last season in a bit, and everyone can see it around him. Mm-hmm. But the exact foil to Carmi is someone like Marcus, who is finding inspiration everywhere he goes. He's channeling his emotions into his cooking. He's taking pictures. He's reading notebooks. He's always trying to do a different technique. And that's, you know, a way of him grieving, as we found with his mother in the first couple episodes. And it's cathartic and it's therapeutic. And this is how he's, you know, getting over losing his mother, is by becoming the best chef he can be. That's a positive thing for him. And Carmi is almost the exact opposite. Him being a chef was to get away from everything he's ever known, all the abuse he ever went through, all the abandonment issues he has. And so he's just really good at it because he told himself that if he did, he doesn't have to remember or think about the bad things that happened in his life.
Yeah, well put.
So those are some of the notes I have on it.
Yeah, I think they're pretty solid. I still got to finish a few. Like I said, I think it's good. It just hasn't clicked. I mean, can we admit now this is not a comedy as well? Like, this season definitely is not a comedy.
Well, anytime Maddie Matheson and Ricky Steffi,
yes, he's the only part.
They are so good together. And this, you know, the senior thing was like a nice little break. Like I talked about it being a palate cleanser. Like, those guys know when the audience, I think, has had enough in terms of stress. Like after we've seen the Christmas episode and I think it was episode 2 where Richie and Carmi were just yelling at each other in the kitchen.
Yeah.
I think it knows when to give us a little bit of a break. But you're right. It's definitely not a comedy.
I also just kind of want them to go back to just making subs. I want that restaurant. I don't want the fine dining. I want that restaurant.
The Italian
I miss that pizza restaurant. And I gotta say too, I was talking to Nick about this. Cousin is a great actor. Man, I can't see Ben Grimm from him. I just do not see him being Ben Grimm. And look, we've been proven wrong on these castings in the past.
Right.
But like Nick and I were talking this pretty extensive. I just don't see Ben Grimm. I do not see the thing from him. I think that's a bad casting.
Well, you know more about this than I do. How would you describe Ben Grimm's character to people?
Rough, tortured.
Isn't that
handsome Rick guy that, you know, everything taken away from him?
Okay. Okay.
And I just the personality that he has, watching him on Jon Stewart, watching him on like Fallon, I just don't see it. I mean, look, I didn't see it from Ledger being Joker, right? So I am willing to be proven wrong like I have before. But currently, and Nick and I were talking about this after, like, I actually kind of think in that Fantastic Four casting overall, I think all the casting is pretty bad outside of Vanessa Kirby.
You don't like Pedro, hey?
He's fine, but he's not Reed Richards to me.
Do you think that we're going to get some, I'm not going to call it like a different version of the Fantastic Four, but do you think that we are going to get some kind of different personality traits out of all of them, like, because I don't know them very well at all. So I always thought like Ben Grimm was kind of like one of those guys who was like, he seemed like he was putting on a show. Like he was, you know, ultimately he was kind of sad about his life, you know, being turned into a monster. But like, you know, he's always the kind of guy who's going to make the joke to make other people feel good about himself, or about himself, but feel good. You know, Reed Richards is kind of like that guy who's like, you know, he seems kind of overly positive, or like
he's an asshole.
Is he really? I don't know. He's an
asshole. Is he? Reed's an asshole.
Okay. So maybe I just, because I've watched, you know, cartoon versions of Fantastic Four.
Yeah, Reed's an asshole.
Okay, what about Sue and Johnny?
Johnny, you know, it just kind of, what's the word? I would have used rambunctious. he's just kind of freestyled, like wild child type of thing, right? Like he has these powers, he's still a teenager and just kind of wants to just do whatever.
Yeah. Okay. And Sue, because she's like, they're usually
Sue's
together.
Super smart. Sue's super Sue smart, super intelligent.
But not.
And she has one of the better powers in the entire team too, right? Like not only can she go invisible, but she has a lot of other techniques too. I mean, it's why when her and Reed do have a child that they created arguably the most powerful comic character ever.
Who's that again?
Franklin Richards.
Okay. Okay. Got
it. He just has to have a thought of your power that you have and you're done.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So good luck with that, anybody.
It's kind of funny, like through our childhood. I mean, I guess we're putting a pin in the bear for right now because we're talking about Eben Moss Backrack. In my childhood growing up, there never was a definitive Fantastic Four property that was so good that was must watch.
No.
So I never actually fell in love, like, of all the characters or all the franchises, DC, X-Men, Marvel, Spider-Man. They aren't even on my, close to being on my radar. Like I could not give two shits about anything the Fantastic Four have ever done. Cause I've also never read a lot of crossover stuff with Marvel either, but like I was way more interested in Batman as a kid. Why? Because the animated series is really good, because the, you know, the Schumacher movies were interesting because of Michael Keaton. And then of course, as you're a teenager, Christian Bale, Spider-Man, pretty easy as well. Tobey Maguire. So I'm interested. I myself, because I'm not the Marvel fanboy that you are, I am going into Fantastic Four with an open mind, because I'm not going to put anything that I know of the characters onto these people because I don't really know anything. So,
yeah, and it could be wrong. For me to round with the bear, like I said, you know, Napkins was, again, a really masterful episode. It does annoy me that this is labeled as a comedy because I do not find it a comedy. And for me personally, I think you nailed a lot of great things of the storytelling and everything like that. I do think it has taken a few steps back. And like I said, right now, for the pecking order of these June shows, I mean, it's still second because The Boys and The Acolyte, like we said, well, having positive moments, they are definitely not hitting the beats that we had them. So The Bear is a number two to me, but House of the Dragon is a clear number one, and it's not even close. House of the Dragon is probably the second best show of the year so far.
So just because I don't have anything to talk about other than things you're going to mention to me about House of the Dragon.
I'll talk about it with Andy. It's just been really good.
My last couple things about The Bear. So episode one was very clearly like the Emmy episode they're going to submit. Hey, with all like minimal dialogue.
It was like a mini movie. It was like a short film.
And a soundtrack by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. Like, holy shit, that was really cool. That was a nice little change of pace. What I think I've started to notice about these episodes is that they're kind of using like a storytelling medium or a camera trick very particularly, but only in one episode at a time. So like the first episode was the flashback episode. The second one is obviously focused on Richie and Carmen fighting a lot, right? It was almost like, exactly, there was no dialogue and it was just that ticking clock sound, or not dialogue, sorry, no music. And then when it came to the Napkins episode, Ayo Edebiri as the director, I'm pretty sure used multi-camera, like, you know, old style sitcoms like Cheers, to get the cuts between Barenthal and Tina's character. And so what's happening is now, like, they're kind of showing off, not that what they're doing is like these camera tricks that have never ever been done before, but kind of like what we noticed in the in the season with the one take, or what we saw the Christmas episode. What we're seeing now is like very confident filmmakers demonstrating just an idea, like a very simple idea of what you learn at film school. Like within the first semester, you're like, oh, we're going to talk about multi-camera. And then we have Cena's cameo. What do you think that was? I think it was improv.
Of course it was. So, I mean, and he had 20 plus years of improv at WWE. So
absolutely. But like that episode, I mean, it doesn't really matter what happened in the episode. What matters is that they told themselves this episode, we're going to do improv, basically improv only, or improv with these three guys, and we're going to let them shine. And so like, I find that like very, really cool that they're not oversaturating every episode with different kind of camera tricks and lighting, or whatever, or different kind of like things that we have to notice. It's just that, you know, the first episode is the montage, the second episode is the fight, the third episode is the improv, the other episode is multi-camera, because they don't do that every other episode. They don't do a lot of multi-camera stuff. So I just thought that was really interesting. So what I've almost been going through these episodes, I think it took me three to realize that they were doing something different every episode. I've been spending time while I've been watching the show trying to figure out what the director is showing me, what the director is trying to do. On top of like, if it's just them fighting and saying, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, no, fuck you, like that's when your mind starts to think about, okay, how are they filming this? And what are they trying to show without dialogue? That's what I've been getting at.
Yeah. All right. So that'll do it for the Bear. Devin higher than I am on that. A light review of Axel F, because Devin hasn't seen it yet.
I have not. No.
All I'll say is this. It's very nice to have seen the third Beverly Hills Cop movie.
We make that joke way too often about a lot of things.
It's just, you know, Eddie still makes me laugh. Eddie means a lot to me as a comedian. And I was talking to Nick and I was talking to my folks about this the other day of like your comedian Mount Rushmore. I'm not going to really talk about the film as much until you see it, Dev. I'll just say I enjoyed it. I gave it 3.5 stars in Letterboxd.
Okay.
That's
respectable.
Yeah. Nick also gave it 3.5. It's a 70 on Rotten Tomatoes right now.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
That's surprising. That's pretty good.
My comedic actor, Mount Rushmore.
Okay.
Eddie Murphy.
Okay.
Will Ferrell. Sandler Murray.
Jeez. Holy crap. Okay. The thing about like comedy Mount Rushmore is like they're. Who do you think? How many do you think qualify for Mount Rushmore? 15 or 20?
Yeah, about that.
Like, we could just list, like, you didn't even mention Robin Williams, for example.
No. Well, Robin, Bill Hader, Martin Short, Steve Martin, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Maya Rudolph.
I think it's a little early for some of the people you mentioned.
Oh, like Rudolph. Hader. Rudolph was close to me. She's in my top 7, 8.
I think Hader is a little early to tell. I need another show like Barry. I need one more property.
And he's like
Barry.
Sandberg is close, but like I like you kind of said with Hader, like I need more from Sandberg. Like all the Lonely Island stuff is great. Brooklyn 99, awesome. But I need like one more thing, one or two more things from Sandberg.
Do you count Leno or Letterman or comedians? Because they've done stand-up before.
No, because I'm talking about like leading movies.
Okay, so I'm... Do you count Jackie
Robin?
Chan?
Robin was close.
Physical comedy.
He's up there.
Yeah, like mine might be Jackie Chan, Robin Williams. I don't disagree with like the Sandler pick, but then you kind of have to like, do you leave out Carey, Mike Myers?
I do. There's more. Errol. There's more Sandler stuff all time I'd go to. Then there is Jim Carrey stuff I'd go to, and same with Ferrell.
Is Sandler's peak higher than Carrey's peak, or is he just more consistent? Like, how would you rank the two of them?
No, Carrey's peak is higher because he had
three movies:
Dumb and Dumber, The Mask, and Ace Ventura, all in '94. That is unassailable.
Yeah, you'll never beat that.
No one will ever beat that. But okay. I do look at the run of Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, Big Daddy, Waterboy as more enjoyable for me.
That's like a nice consistent run. It was just stretched out.
Yeah. And then, I mean, obviously then he just has like, I like Grown Ups. I like Just Go With Me. Like I like the Sandler's just like, fuck it. I just want to go to locations with my friends.
Yeah, and do these
like, they're just fun movies. And then obviously stuff like Uncut Gems and the Punch Drunk Love, like the PTA stuff that he did is really solid.
What about like Carlin and Pryor? Because those, I think a lot of people.
Yeah, like, those are up there.
Do you particularly enjoy those guys at all? Like,
Yeah. Pryor, see, like, I mean, I love Brewster's Millions, and a lot of people don't care for that, but I love that movie. It's a great movie.
That's the thing about this, like, this Mount Rushmore conversation. Like, every time I'm trying to think I have four settled, it's like, oh, yeah, like, Mitch Hedberg. He wasn't in movies, but, like, I think...
I just kind of go by, these aren't the four that I think are the best. These are my personal four. That's what I'm saying. If we did the best of the best...
Oh, okay.
Then, yes, Jim Carrey has to be on that. But for me, personally, I should have been more clear.
Personal favorite. Personal favorite Mount Rushmore. Okay, yes. Williams, Bill Burr, Jackie Chan. I have like two camps where it's like either I got to go really dark with Bill Burr, or I'm going to go really family friendly with Jackie Chan.
But does Bill Burr have like a lot of like go-to comedy films that you would have to, or are you going to base it more off the stand-up? Because I'm basing it more on leading man in a film.
Okay, so... You know what? Every time he's in a film, like every time Bill's in a film, I really enjoy it, even though like that list is actually very small. So I can.
Have you seen him in the Pete Davidson movie?
Yes.
He's good and he's great in that.
Yes. Like, that's kind of where I'm going with it. Where like every time he's on screen, or like when he showed up as the podcaster in.
Oh, and Hader in Barry?
Barry. It was just like that's one of the highlights of the whole show for me. But okay. So if we're talking about movies in general, I'm not much of a Jim Carrey fan, although I appreciated it for a time. I think
I'm kind of the same. I don't care much for Carrey, but I appreciate.
I gotta go Rogan because I've come to appreciate. I'm gonna go Rogan, Williams, Jackie Chan, and Adam Sandler. I think, but the now, problem with the problem with Adam Sandler is like you gotta take the bad with the good.
Mm-hmm. You gotta take the little Nickies.
I don't mind Little Nicky, but there's worse than
you gotta take. Don't mess with the Zohan.
But even Eddie Murphy, like even like Dr. Doolittle, solid.
Yeah, but there's a bad run, man.
There's Norbert in there. Nutty Professor, good.
Yeah, this is the Eddie run. So the Eddie run in the 80s. I was just looking at this the other day. It's like number one. Let's not forget Eddie saved SNL.
Yes. Okay.
That's first and foremost, right? Eddie saved SNL was done. And Lauren had left SNL and Eddie literally saved SNL.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Eddie's. Eddie's first movie ever is 48 Hours.
Oh, yeah. He came in fully formed. Like he was ready from the get go.
Eddie's second movie ever is Trading Places.
Yeah. And then it's How to Make or Coming to America.
And then it's Beverly Hills Cop. And then it's The Golden Child, which I like. I know everyone's a big fan of it. But then it's Beverly Hills Cop 2. Then it's Coming to America. Wow. Then it's Harlem Nights. Then it's Boomerang, which is awesome. The cast in Boomerang, by the way, just going to give you an idea of how good this cast in Boomerang is. Eddie Murphy, Robin Givens, Halle Berry, Daig, Martin Lawrence, Chris Rock, John Witherspoon.
Wow.
Really, really good.
Actually, you know who we're missing? It's
John Eartha Candy. Kitt's in it, I believe, as well.
It's John Candy.
Yeah, John Candy's up there too. And then it starts. So then he does Beverly Hills Cop 3, bomb, Vampire in Brooklyn, bomb, Nutty Professor, which look, I was a kid when I saw that, so I enjoyed that film.
No, it resurrected personally. Him, though. It resurrected him.
He did.
Sure. No. Did
and then he does Metro, which is not great. Then he does Mulan. Awesome. Dr. Doolittle. Fine. Holy Man. Bad. Life. great. Bowfinger, great. Nutty Professor 2, Shrek, hit. Dr. Doolittle 2, whatever. Showtime, bomb, and then Pluto Nash happens.
Yeah, that's where it gets kind of weird. So,
yeah, then it's I Spy with Owen Wilson, Daddy Daycare, Haunted Mansion. He does the Shreks. I'm not counting. Does Shrek you 2? Count
Shrek?
No, I said I don't count. Like, don't count the Shrek as far as the up and downs. Like, Shrek is just always going to be good. I think, but he does Shrek
enough.
2,
Shrek's enough.
And people are like, oh, he's kind of trailing. Then he does Dreamgirls, and everyone thinks he's going to win the Oscar. But yeah, then Norbit comes out the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, what a weird run. What a lot of ups and downs, hey?
Yeah. And then he does Shrek the Third. Then he does Meet Dave. He does Imagine That. Shrek Forever After. Tower Heist, which was actually not bad. Had Ben Stiller. It was actually not bad. 1,000 Words, not great.
Actually, you know who should be in consideration? Leslie Nielsen.
Leslie Nielsen. And then he does Dolomite's My Name, and that was kind of like a mini comeback for him. But then he does Coming to America, which you and I don't mind. It's not great, but I don't think it's terrible.
Wait, you don't think Coming to America is great?
No, the second, the sequel.
Oh, shit, sorry. Coming to number two, America. I gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. I don't think it's terrible, but it's like a 5.
I think it's fine. I think it didn't hurt him.
No. Then he does You People, which there's like some good stuff in it, but it's mostly bad. But he's good in it.
Mm.
Candy Cane Lane, which I didn't mind, but I know a lot of people didn't like, and now he did Beverly Hills Cop. And okay, Next up, he's going to be doing the Pink Panther, where he's Inspector Clouseau.
Man, what a franchise that has. That's a franchise that we could talk about, like all the ups and downs.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're going to do the Mount Rushmore, I would say this. Number one, with a silver bullet, this is all time, has to be Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Charlie Chaplin has to be number one. I think Robin Williams has to be number two. And I mean, someone would argue like, yeah, you talked about Richard Pryor, Gene Wilder, Jackie. I'd probably do Gene Wilder on there.
Wow. Mel Brooks.
And then maybe Mel Brooks, Jackie Gleason.
It's tough.
Lucille Ball.
Comedians is really, it's way harder than if we were to do actors.
Because you look at men and women like Lucille Ball and Charlie Chaplin and how much they mean to the greater overall picture of what comedy is. Those are two of the most identifiable important people in the history of comedy, with Lucille and with Charlie Chaplin.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's not an easy thing to go with. I did watch Eddie, though, and you look at that 80s right there. Eddie just meant a lot to me growing up and made me laugh quite a bit. I mean, that comedy special is one of the all-time comedy specials.
Delirious, yeah.
Yeah, so. And like I said, Axel F. is great.
We got to watch 3 before we watch Axel F.
You're good. You're good.
My partner was thoroughly impressed by Beverly Hills Cop when we watched it, like in the pandemic, and two. So
yeah, it's great.
I did not think she would be, like, given it's a kind of a buddy cop movie, but I was wrong.
You know, the one thing I really did appreciate about this one is it definitely has that 80s feeling to it.
Does it?
It doesn't lose that feeling that you had of 80s action. It comes back. And I think Nick said it best to me. He's like, everyone gets the right amount of screen time, although I disagree. I could lose more of Judge.
Oh, for sure. He's someone who's with an interesting career. I'm sure we've gone through it, but we'll talk about it later.
I just get them thinking about Arrested Development. My name is Judge.
Yeah.
Okay, two more things, then we're out of here. I beat Luigi's Mansion, Dev.
Okay, all of them.
No, just one so far. I don't have a GameCube. I can't play number one. No, and number two is $80, man.
Hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on. They just did a remake of one for the Switch.
Two.
One.
Two.
I know they have another.
They remade number two for the Switch, not number one.
Hold on a second here.
Yeah. You keep talking. That's why it's Luigi's Mansion 2 HD.
I literally just watched a review on this, I thought. Yeah, okay. Yeah,
it's Luigi's Mansion 2 HD.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
Because yeah. I think this was originally on the 3DS, the two.
Yeah. I've played two and I haven't played three.
I haven't played two yet. It's $80. These game prices, man, they're crazy.
Well, every time we gotta praise Nintendo, we gotta take some marks off for them set the price of games, I think.
Well, I mean, it's not as bad as getting College Game Day. That's gonna cost me $94.
Are you getting like a certain kind of
nope? That's regular. That's just regular.
$94, really? Wow.
Yeah. Yep. So when people say like, "Oh, you spent $130 on PSN," I'm like, "Yeah, that was the smart choice."
Holy shit! Wow.
Although they just took GTA off of it was like halfway through playing GTA and they took it off.
I think it kind of comes and goes a lot. Unless this is, they're just going to take it off now and just make people buy it for an anticipation.
Yeah, well, there's a new DLC that came out, so that's probably why. I want people to buy the game of the DLC, but no, with Ouija's, it was it's an interesting thing of like, it's one of those games that at times it's not super easy, but there is difficult things at times in it, and it makes it both fantastic and annoying. Because there was times like, I don't think I can beat this boss. I do not think I can beat this boss. And then you do, and you just have that great feeling like, holy shit, I did it. But there's times when I'm not very good in gaming at shooting. That's why I don't play Call of Duties or Fortnite or anything like that. I am not good at aiming. I have a shaky hand. And so I am not good at aiming stuff. So like for when the last game is, you have to take like these bombs and put them into King Boo's mouth.
Right.
To get him on the ground. I'm like, this is the one trait I am terrible at of games is aiming stuff.
It's such a well-designed game that gets held back by the 3DS controls.
That's what the IGN review was saying.
And it sounds like, from what I understand, also because it's on the Switch, the two Joy-Con control scheme just fits a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah, I will play. I mean, I was going to play it, but then I'm like, I'm going to play College Game Day. So why would I spend $80 now for a game I'm going to be playing for a while with College Game Day? So I might as well wait for that and spend my money there. Cause I mean, it's not like back in the day where it's like, oh, games are $50. I could buy two of these and beat this and do this. Like you gotta be selective
100% on stuff
more than ever now. So, but you know, Luigi's Mansion, it's a franchise that I will always go back to. Like I really enjoyed it and they continue to push forward. I don't think the Switch is my favorite console of all time, but man, it is top two to three all time for me. I think the favorite console I have ever owned is either my SNES or my PS3.
Ooh, I think PS4 is up there.
PS4 is up there. Xbox 360 is up there.
360 was an excellent console. That, like, everyone had one of those.
I think number one would still be my SNES. Okay. I think that's number one. Super Nintendo's probably number one. PlayStation 3 or 4. Let's just give it to 4. It's probably number two. And then the Switch is probably 3. And then Xbox 360. And then let's go PS3 there. Because I never had a PS2, which I know some people consider that to be the greatest console. But for me, mm-hmm. those are probably mine.
Man, we're doing a lot of lists today. I think the PS, I think the original Xbox for me, N64.
Yeah, N64 had a lot of good memories too.
The PS4 though just continues to be this workhorse, and kind of like the Switch, where the Switch has allowed a lot like Nintendo to really breathe a lot and to reintroduce a lot of their franchises to people of all ages.
Mm-hmm.
In a convenient factor, it's transformable. You can take both of them off. You can hook up to a TV. You can play with a controller. You can play with two sticks. Like, but because it's been around so long, they're giving a lot of people opportunities to play remakes or digital downloads. Like, even just you with the Luigi's Mansion. Like, I'm sorry we had that argument there. I swore I just watched a video review on it, but I think it was Luigi's Mansion 2. They just didn't say 2.
It's okay. I had this argument twice now. Everyone thinks, oh, well, why they would review the original?
Well, I mean, I kind of keep up with Nintendo stuff. I kind of don't sometimes, but either way. So I could definitely see the Switch being very, like, because it scratches. It
got so flustered I spelled Mansion wrong.
Eh, whatever. It checks so many boxes for so many different kinds of gamers. Like, it's really accessible to everybody. The reason why PS4 was so successful was because Sony just said, hold my beer, we're going to reinvent AAA video games. And here's all the franchises we're going to do it with. Like, to reintroduce God of War, to do Last of Us, to do Horizon Zero Dawn, to do Persona 5, to do whatever. And just, like, so when you're, like, I don't think there's such a thing as a hardcore gamer, but that's as close to the definition that I would use, that hardcore gamers went to the PS4 to play hardcore games.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think when you hit two about the Switch, it's true. Like, for me, like, you know, I skipped three generations, you know, starting off. I never had a Game Boy, but, you know, I had an NES, I had a SNES, I had an N64. And then I didn't have a GameCube, didn't have a Wii, and I didn't have a Wii U. So three generations I missed of games and everything like that. And now that I'm back, I'm just like, yeah, forever engaged in all these franchises.
You know? Well, the one thing I'll say about Nintendo games, and I'll especially with Luigi's Mansion 2, like, minus the boss battles, for such a good chunk of the game, I just liked wandering at my own pace, exploring a room, trying to suck stuff up, finding a secret entrance, finding secret ghosts. Like, it was
Luigi's a really nice addition for that too.
It's not a cozy game because that's Stardew Valley and whatever, but what it's basically like the action version of a cozy game. Like, I'm really kind of coming back to the idea of like
great. I think it's not like with like Souls, or I'm just doing Ghost of Tsushima right now, and there's times I'm like, no, I don't want to face you, I'm running away. You're not doing that as much like running from the ghost in Luigi's Mansion.
Nothing about the game is particularly challenging other than the bosses, which after like a couple hours of you exploring like this mansion, then you're like, oh, okay, I'm ready to like try a boss for a little bit. And it takes you three or four tries, maybe five tries. I'm kind of really starting to come around back to the idea of these like collectathon games, 3D platformer games. I mean, of course, Mario 64 is like the gold standard, but even like the idea of a Lego game. And I played, you know, Skywalker Saga a couple of years ago, as did you. That game was not hard. That wasn't supposed to be hard, but I loved like breaking shit. I loved building shit. I loved collecting shit. And it was just like a nice little use of like, it turned my brain off and I just got to relax.
I kind of have a Dave the Diver, to be honest.
I don't relax a lot when I play video games because I also play like really freaking hard, dumb video games sometimes.
Playing Sekiro.
Yeah, to 100%.
What do you mean the monkey's not dead?
Oh my gosh, yeah. What do you mean there's. And then later you fight two monkeys, so get ready. God. But I like the idea of these, like, and you know what? It's the same as music. It's like different genres are trying to accomplish different things. Taylor Swift is not trying to accomplish the same thing as Metallica does. Just like how sometimes I'm in the mood for Lego Skywalker, sometimes I'm in the mood for Sekiro. So it just depends on whatever itch I have, but I'm happy that there are games out there that can scratch kind of both itches, or, you know, not at the same time, of course, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty cool. I went from RPG to Mansion, so two like pretty iconic games for the Nintendo console, and get to beat the. I mean, this Switch run I want to move on because I want to get out of here. But this, I mean, you look at the this console alone, just having Odyssey, the Zelda stuff it's had. Didn't have a Donkey Kong game because technically Tropical Freeze is a Wii U game.
Yes.
Right. But you know, having Luigi's Mansion on here, having some considered other than Melee, I still think people consider Melee the best Smash, but this Smash was pretty good. Didn't technically have a Mario Kart because this Mario Kart was for the Wii U as well, but a very extended Mario Kart on it. Having Mario Wonder, one of the best 2D platforms, having Bowser's Fury, which might be the future of what a Mario game is. And that game still took my breath away of the seamlessness between the stages and the worlds that it all had. Like, that was phenomenal in its own right that it did. And, you know, Donkey says this best, like, Nintendo doesn't miss very much. When they make a game, you know it's going to be in good care, right? And I think that's why, you know, you and I always gravitate towards Naughty Dog for right? Because we know that Naughty Dog, they're not messing around. When they give you a game, I think that's one of the reasons Naughty Dog hasn't announced a game, because they're not going to do anything until they know it's to their perfection, because they have a perception of making the best games out there. Like, all four Uncharted games, seamless, fantastic. Yeah. Both Last of Us games, perfect. You know, and same with From Software now, right? From Software is not going to put anything out unless they know it's perfect. And I think, you know, if someone like From Software saw what happened to CJ Project Red, and like, we don't want to have someone come like, oh, well, after everything was fixed out, that Elden Ring game was great. No, they want to make sure when they give you the Elden Ring DLC that it's exactly what you're expecting, that it's not going to be a buggy mess like Cyberpunk was on arrival. And then afterwards, it's great. But, you know, that's what you're getting from the best developers now. And that's why Nintendo, From Software, and Naughty are probably the top three right now.
Well, we just get, you know, one word describes all of those developers, and people find a lot of different things fun. So Nintendo, their focus is on fun and their focus is on innovation. Mm-hmm. And if their games don't check either of those boxes, they don't have to check both. Sometimes they do. A lot of times they do. They're not going to release it, or they're going to keep workshopping the idea until they find something. So what that means is they kind of become a top down or a bottom up studio, where they figure out their gameplay element first that makes it unique and interesting and draws people in to try, you know, the new Zelda games can be interesting. Breath of the Wild, Odyssey, right? But that's an idea that they had to think about, and then they had to build it from there. They didn't come from the other way around, where they had to shoehorn it in and then suddenly like a bunch of mechanics don't really make sense. That's why Nintendo stands out. Naughty Dog stands out for one thing: storytelling. And whether that be directly, whether that be through things that we control the character do, whether that be through cutscenes, like they are gonna make the best possible moving, grounded, mature, realistic, heart-wrenching story that they could possibly do. And then they're gonna make you shoot some guys.
Yes.
And From Software has been known for one thing: challenge. When you tell people that you've 100%ed or beat or whatever a From Software game, any of them, Bloodborne, Demon's Souls, Sekiro, Armored Core 6, people look at you and go, damn, like, you're dedicated. And it just so happens that I find myself being any one of those boxes at any point in time. But I like the fact that I go from one to the other to the other. And so a lot of these like indie studios are kind of, they dabble in things or they experiment with things. But these studios, which makes them AAA, is the fact that they are committed to those few words throughout the entire development process of a game. They don't take any shortcuts until you walk out of that game, put that game in its disc, or you delete it off your console, and you're like, damn, like, that game was fun, that game was challenging, that game was life-changing, as in the case of Last of Us 1 and 2. So I love the fact that basically what happens is we have three, there's probably a few more developers that don't miss, but because they're allowed to, they've crafted themselves. Even Miyazaki went around and he said, like, just a couple weeks ago, he's like, when I'm president of this company, I am not going to lay people off, because people who are afraid of being laid off are going to take shortcuts and compromises, and they're not going to be as creative as if they feel when they're secure.
Yeah.
And that's the guy from Software. Like, he wants his employees, even if they're going to lose money, to be so secure in their job that they can just be creative and free thinking.
I bet you, during the Last of Us 2 documentary that you can find on YouTube, Druckmann said he will never put his employees in the crunch situation again.
Right.
And I think half the reason why we haven't got the Naughty Dog game announcement is because he won't do it until he knows there is no such reason for a crunch or anything like that. Like, whenever this Naughty Dog game comes out for the PS5, it'll literally be like, hey, it's out in like 5 months, because they'll know where it is. Because
I'm
100% sure Naughty Dog is 30, 40% through whatever game they're doing. Probably. Right now.
Oh yeah. They, but Sony has every incentive to not shake the boat.
Yeah.
So it's just like, you do whatever you want. You give us a date and we're just going to keep writing you checks, because it doesn't matter how long it takes. It doesn't matter how big the budget. We will quite literally, like, you will sell us millions of consoles and you will get us so much press and attention, and you will get so many YouTube videos based on the games that we can only play on PlayStation.
You know what? I wouldn't be shocked if they are making Last of Us 3 right now and they'll coincide it with the show next year.
Great. I mean, I heard rumors, or not rumors, I'm sure we've all read the same thing, that it was going to be a new IP and that Last of Us 3 is going to be the next game after that.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
Who knows, man?
I want a Naughty Dog Western game, man.
I'm kind of okay with only playing one, you know, just Rockstar being like, we're going to make Western games. Western games. I'm fine with that too. I don't know what kind of setting that they would want to do. That'd be interesting.
Red Dead came on PS Now, and I'm like, I think I'm ready to go back.
Two or one?
Two.
Okay. Did you ever play one?
No, I never did.
Oh, man, that story.
It is on there, and I have debated doing one as well.
It doesn't take nearly as long as two. The story is worth trying out, especially because you know the characters.
All right. Hollywood Rundown. Helldivers 2 boss response to complaints that Elden Ring's DLC is difficult. A game for everyone is a game for no one, is quote. Kind of true.
It is true. Yeah, absolutely is true.
Like, I would never, I know I am not good enough of a video game player to play Elden Ring. Like, I would like to try, but I know I more than likely could not beat it. I do not think I am that good of a gamer.
That is not true. Okay, I don't want anyone to think that any game is locked out for them.
I'd be overwhelmed by it. Maybe one day I'll do it, but I'm just like, I'm good.
How do you learn a language? How did you learn how to drive? You started with baby steps, right? And so what happens is, when you start a From Software game, it's that you have to be comfortable with the process of learning. And yeah, if you tell yourself you're going to get frustrated early, well, then you're not going to get very far. But if you have some determination where you're like, I'm going to just try this 10 times before I put it down, and I'm going to get a little further each time, that's how you play a From Software game.
Are you familiar with this Hypercharge game, Dev?
No, I'm not.
It's a game with the toy soldiers and like the toys that have, it's like a shooter.
Oh, it's supposed to be like Army Men? I mean,
yeah, it's already sold over 100K in copies on Xbox, and it'll be on PS5 later this month. Later this year.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I've seen a couple of playthroughs of some when it was like in beta or whatever. Just looks kind of cool, looks kind of fun, reminds me of Army Men.
Godzilla and Kong 2 will come out in 2027. I haven't seen it, but it makes money. So, you know, you keep on doing your thing, Universal.
Are they
going... Warner Brothers? Whoever it is, keep on doing your thing.
Are they going to fight again, you think?
They're teaming up now.
Yeah, I know. But, I mean, they teamed up in the last movie, right?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. We'll see what happens. Dune 3 is expected to release December 18, 2026. Denis Villeneuve is actually working on the script. Cast schedules have been locked in for the film. Release date was set with the expectation ready to go. Interesting on this. I think right now the date is also shared by Mando and Grogu.
That'll change because they will push it back, or I don't know. I don't believe anything Star Wars says anymore.
Neither do I. What else do we got that's exciting? It's been a very quiet week, by the way. Redbox has filed for bankruptcy. Employees haven't received paychecks in over a week. Money is owed to major entities, including Walmart, Walgreens, Universal, Sony, Warner. They face dozens of lawsuits from Uphill Build, and the company is in $1 million debt.
Well, who knew they were still renting DVDs in 2024?
Yeah. Inside Out made $1 billion. So Adam is probably going to win this box office thing now because he has the other $1 billion movie coming up here.
Damn it.
I need Minions, man. Minions, save me this week.
Who would have I mean, obviously he thought it was going to do very well. I find these Disney movies hard to predict, but I haven't seen a Disney movie in like 10 years. So.
You haven't seen Moana?
Nope.
You haven't seen Frozen?
Nope.
What?
I'm serious. I saw Soul. That was the last, other than that, I can't remember the last movie I saw.
You need to see Moana.
No, I think I'm good. I'm good with
culturally important films.
You know what? There will be people in my life in the future who will make me watch those movies. So I'm saving it to be impressed with little people who will be impressed.
Yeah, they're very important. Crazy Taxi. Have you seen the trailer for the Crazy Taxi game?
Yes. It looks wild. Amazing. Looks great.
Looks so good. Metal Gear Solid film is still in development. We're working on the script more and more, and I think everyone's going to be really excited and surprised. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, basically. I mean, isn't that Jason Voight Roberts? Was he doing that, or is he doing the Gundam? Yeah, Jordan Voight Roberts is supposed to do it. Yeah. So it's like, I'll believe it when I see it, I suppose. That's kind of like, I put him in the same category as Duncan Jones, who made Moon and then made the Warhammer movie or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
He did Skull Island, Kong Skull Island. And it's like, okay, like let's go. Like, let's move on here.
Capcom confirms Resident Evil 9 is in development.
Cool.
Michael Rucker says that TikTok ruined attention span for moviegoers. Everything is 90 minutes now. Get over that shit. Watch a movie that tells the story when you grow. It's learn to watch real cinema. I don't think TikTok did that. I think that's an easy excuse. I think the idea of having a phone and having the access to watch media did that. Yes, there is shorter attention spans to watch something quick on a reel or on a TikTok, but I also think the sense of media is more driven that people care less about watching it on a bigger screen and more on either their laptop or their phone or their iPad.
Okay.
That's just kind of what I see. Devin, I know you're excited for this. Your favorite franchise ever is coming out with its third movie, November 14th, 2025, and everybody is back for the third movie.
Can I guess?
Yeah.
Now You See Me.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I literally guessed. Oh my gosh. I can't wait not to see it.
Everyone's back.
Cool.
There have been no meetings with filmmakers over the next James Bond movie yet. Not too surprised.
Well, yeah.
They got to pick a Bond first. And then other than that, not too much. Like I said, it was pretty quiet overall. Horizon Zero Dawn series is dead at Netflix. That's about it.
I'm going to assume there's going to be a lot of video game announcements that don't end up actually getting off of the development floor because...
Like Bioshock?
Well, when it comes to movies and television, yeah, there's just... What people need to start looking at some of these anime adaptations and kind of get the feeling that if we need to let properties breathe sometimes. And a big part of Bioshock is the exploration in the environment. And yeah. You know that they're going to just focus on like the action and the sets. And
I think it's kind of like Resident Evil.
Just more. There's more to it than that, right? It's like the exploration. It's the creepiness. It's you finding things. It's you getting lost. It's you getting scared. For someone to also feel that, for someone to film that and make you feel that way in four episodes might be difficult. So,
all right, that'll do it for us. Devin is going on hiatus for 2 weeks. We'll see him back at the end of the month, and just in time for Deadpool Wolverine. And we'll have the recaps for the Acolyte, for the Boys, and for the Bear with Devin at that point. We'll have a fill-in for the next 2 weeks for him. So adios to Dev, and until next time, folks, cheers and enjoy the day, people.
Thank you for listening to the Fresh Take Network. Follow us on social media platforms at Fresh Take 42.